guidance and motivation.
Okay, you can hear me, fine. Yeah. So I hope that Chris has whet your appetite for more supersymmetric logics, as I mentioned. What I'd like to talk about today is going looking more in detail to some of these brain models which describe which can describe supersymmetric logics or dimensions and look closer up at their physics. So let me begin just by emphasizing again that the main ideas about supersymmetric logics dimensions, why it's interesting to look at them. Pretty much in the same what Cliff told you, but in my own way, I hope it will be interesting. So the first point is that brain worlds can may be able to provide a new way to look at the cosmological constant problem because they can change the way that gravity responds to the vacuum energy. So in particular, vacuum energy localized from the brain can curve the extra dimensions rather than the intrinsic spacetime. So, for example, if I take a three-brain localized in six extra dimensions and I look at the Einstein's equations, what I find is that the brain gravitationally back reacts in such a way to produce a conical defect in the extra dimensions where the strength of the defect, the deficit angle, depends on is proportional to the tension of the brain. So the reason why we look just at these brain world models in six dimensions is that they may provide some insight into this phenomenological relationship between the cosmological constant and the other hierarchy, big hierarchy problem in fundamental physics, which is the gauge hierarchy problem. So we already know from Arkani, Hamid, Bavali, and Demopoulos that the hierarchies between the electroweak scale and the Planck scale might be able to be explained in terms of submillimeter size extra dimensions. And what we ask is that if we introduce supersymmetric large extra dimensions into the picture, might they also be able to describe provide an explanation for the hierarchy in the cosmological constant. So in supersymmetric large extra dimensions, the brains are playing two different key roles. First is that they allow us to change gravity at the scale of the cosmological constant, exactly at the submillimeter scale. And second, they allow us to separate the supersymmetry breaking scales on the brain and in the bulk. So the picture will be that we know that supersymmetry has to be badly broken on the brain because we haven't observed it broken at least at electroweak scale. And because the brain, of course, couples to the bulk, that supersymmetry breaking has to trickle down into the bulk. But it's only coupled gravitationally, and so the supersymmetry breaking scale in the bulk can again be suppressed right down to the cosmological constant scale. So the hope is that we could explain not only why the cosmological constant is zero, but also why it's so terribly small. So the picture would be that supersymmetry is badly broken on the brain, giving rise to a vacuum energy on the brain, the electroweak scales. But this vacuum energy is localized and gravitationally back reacts such as to curve the bulk and not the brain. On the other hand, the vacuum energy contributions from the bulk can be suppressed by supersymmetry right down to a much lower scale, potentially down to the scale of the cosmological constant. So this is the big question. Can the bulk contributions to vacuum energy be suppressed right down to the cosmological constant scale, which would be the Susie breaking scale to the power of 4. So typically, we know that the vacuum energy contributions should be suppressed at least of order of the Susie breaking scale squared, but can they really be suppressed right down to the Susie breaking scale to the power of 4, which is the cosmological constant scale? And what properties do we need in order for that suppression to occur? So this is going to be the summary of the talk. I'll talk about some particular brain world models in six-dimensional supergravity, which Cliff mentioned, These can be regarded as a laboratory in which to investigate the ideas of supersymmetric larger dimensions, and also co-dimension two brains in general. So the main point of the talk will be discussing the perturbations to these brain world solutions, which is the first step in asking and what the low energy physics would be. This is not a very easy problem because we have a lot of fields around, they will couple, and so we have big coupled differential systems to solve. And we managed to go really quite far with them. We even managed to get quantitative complete analytic results for the perturbations. These quantitative results allow us to derive to see some of the qualitative properties of co-dimension two brains. We compare the results that we get with co-dimension one brains, five-dimensional brain world models, and also the standard Pulitzer prime compactification. I think this is just interesting in its own right to see five-dimensional brain worlds have been studied really quite well. We know a lot about them by now, and I think the same can be said about co-dimensional two brains as well now, and we can see how they are similar and how they differ to the lower dimension co-dimension and also standard Pulitzer prime compactification. So this is the framework in which we'll be studying these issues. Six-dimensional n equals 1 goes to the gravity in the bulk. You saw it from Cliff. There's gravity, there's a dilaton. There's a free-form field strength, which is part of the supergravity supermultiplet. There we have some number of non-abelian gauge fields in the bulk, some hyperscalars, and there's the protection. So the points to note first is that we have a gauge R symmetry. This G is the coupling for U1 R symmetry, and this leads to a positive definite scalar potential, which has a minimum where the hyperscalars are zero. Also, the fermions are chiral. In general, this means that we can have both gauge and gravitational anomalies, but these can be cancelled by a Green-Schwarz mechanism. In an analogous way to what happens in 10D, for particular matter and gauge symmetry groups. In particular, for example, the number of hypermultiplets has to be related to the dimension of the gauge multiplets. So to this bulk theory, we'll add a number of three-brain sources with this action, intention of the brain, the Ys describe the embedding of the three-brain in the six dimensions. So this solution, theory, we're able to find general solutions. In particular, if we ask for maximal symmetry in four dimensions, axial symmetry in two dimensions, and at most conical singularity, we're able to find the explicit general solution. I don't give you all the details, just want you to notice that in this general solution, the restriction of four-dimensional maximal symmetry actually leads us to a flat 4D slices, as opposed to de Sitter, anti de Sitter. The extra dimensions are compact. They're supported by a monopole-like configuration in the Yang-Mill sector. But in general, there can be some warping, which is supported by non-trivial profiling and dilaton. And in general, the solution will have at most two conical singularities if you have axial symmetry in the two dimensions. And the strength of the conical singularities is related to the retentions of the brains. And in terms of the bulk equations of motion, they're just integration forces. So rather than giving you the details of the solution, I just want to give you an intuition about the geometry. If we take the deficit angles to be equal, then the warp factor goes to 1, and we recover the unwarped rugby ball. So we have basically the two sphere with the two tensions of equal tensions at the poles of the brain, deficit angle of the sphere. As we take the deficit angles to to zero, we recover the classic smooth sphere monopole compactification. So just a quick aside, that the geometry sourced by negative tension grains is perfectly well defined. When we have a conical defect with a positive depth angle, we can picture it as starting with a flat disk and splicing out the wedge from the cone gluing together the edges. For negative deficit angle, we simply splice in a wedge, and that's the geometry. So for the final point I want to make about the solution is that since we have a topology of a sphere, the formed sphere, with a monopole-like configuration, we have, of course, a direct quantization condition. So this is a topological constraint on the background, and which we can write in terms of what's known as the monopole numbers, which are integers. So for every charged field that we have an associated integer called the monopole number. This is also providing a topological constraint between the tensions of the brain, it's omega, omega bar. Yeah, please.
Is it true the solutions that you were talking about all assume premium on the brain is pure tension? In other words, how would the story change in the measure? Has it changed significantly? Do you continue? Is this curving leaving all the temperature in the bulk and not on the brain is so powerful that it's insensitive to putting that on the brain in your bag?
I think the fair thing is that what we know is that the solutions are general, so we can find the most general maximally symmetric solutions in the bulk, say, and then the issue is how do you match those solutions to the brain, and it's kind of for co-dimension two brains that's more subtle than it normally is in co-dimension one, and you can kind of see that with when you get curvature singularities, what's happening there is that if the brain is sourcing the dilaton, that's setting up gradients of the dilaton as you approach the brain, and those gradients have stress energy which pull the curvature after it, and that's why you're getting the singularities. And so what we know is we can take the solutions we have and match them onto some choice for the brain action, but we typically choose that brain action to be a function only of bulk fields. And we don't, with one exception, we did an example where we coupled the massive field on the brain to the bulk, but only then we integrated it out to see what it did to the loops. We didn't actually let it evolve classically. So I don't think we've really explored the solutions where we have fields rolling in both.
I guess my question is, on the one hand, I worry whether, how powerful is this magnetic property of extra dimensions against gray matter, right, arbitrary matter, like the same model. On the other hand, I'm also worried that, that it's so powerful that actually you make that redundant what you want, right, which is not what you want.
You mean for, like, for inflation or something?
Well, our universe today is manifesting.
Yeah.
Right. You don't want to get that all the time.
You're worried about, like solar system or something. Because of gravity. Right. Yeah, that works in the sense that you have a massive split spine. Once you're average, you do reproduce general relativity, but it's a scalar tensor theory because you also have a scalar field. So there's an issue of satisfying the solar system bounds to do that coupling of the scalar field. But given that that works, then you get for free, you don't say that the solar system will be flat. Right?
I see.
Because there is a massless Kluge-Klein mode, which is grabbing below the, once you're below the Kluge-Klein scale, it's looking like four-dimensional gravity coupled to a scalar field, coupled to whatever's on the right.
I see.
So one of the things, just parenthetically, so then there's an issue of what stabilizes the Kluge-Klein scale, which is going to hold in the right direction, which we can talk about.
Yeah, so actually that leads me into my next point, which is that after having established the background solution, then we want to ask about the physics, especially for the observer. So we want to ask questions like, are these solutions stable to small perturbations? What would be the symmetry of the particle content of the low energy for the effective field theory? What would be the modifications for the Newtonian gravity? And in particular, for this question, what is the effective acting energy measured by for the observer. What we'd like to know is what role do the brains, the codimension two brains, play in these phenomena, and how are the codimension two brains different to five dimensional brains in traditional Pulitzer Klein models? So what I want to talk about today is in particular the linearized perturbations about these solutions. I'll focus on the bosonic perturbations. So in general, we have the metric perturbations, the non-engageable perturbations, the dilaton perturbations, the Kalman field, and the positions of the brains in the extra dimensions. I'm actually going to truncate those by, for example, placing the brain on an orbital fixed point. So what we want to do is vary the action with respect to these variations. The leading order term would be the 4D classical vacuum energy, the vacuum energy of the solution, which in our case is zero. The first order term will be zero thanks to the equations of motion, the background equations of motion, and the leading order term, non-zero term, will be the bilinear action, which governs the linearized dynamics of perturbation. So just for example, I write down here one of the terms in the action for the metric perturbations. Bilinear, the covariant derivatives depend in the background curvature, and of course it depends on the background configurations. We also have some contributions from the brain action. So this bilinear action is invariant under a set of transformations of the field with parameters eta, chi, and lambda. These variations descend from the symmetries of the full six-dimensional theory, that is six-dimensional coordinate invariant, six-dimensional gaze symmetry, the Kalman symmetry. We can use these symmetries to fix the gauge of the bilinear action. So we will use a fix to the light cone gauge, define some light cone coordinates, and fix the minus components of the field to zero using these transformations. It then turns out that the plus components can be eliminated from the equations of motion to leave only the physical degrees of freedom. So we fix the gauge completely. At the end of the gauge fixing, it turns out that the different spin sectors decouple. It's still not a very easy problem. We have some large couple of differential systems to solve. In particular, the scalars lead to an 8x8 coupled second order differential equations. So the problem is not very easy. We're able to solve these smaller systems completely for the general warp solutions. For the larger 5x5, 8x8 systems, we're able to find analytic solutions, the complete Pulitzer Klein spectrum for the unwarped models. We've also looked at some of the fermionic sectors. So let me here present just as an example of the complication. The spin one perturbations, which is a 5x5 system for the unwarped pluggable. So the linearized dynamics are governed by this bilinear action. We have the terms in so these are vectors, four dimensional vectors descending from the metric. A 4D vector descending from the higher dimensional gauge field, and a 4D vector descending from the two-form potential, the Kalman field. So the I's are indices, the 4D indices orthogonal to the light cone coordinates, and M's are the internal coordinates. So the thing that makes it difficult are these derivative couplings in action between the gauge coming from the high dimensional gauge field and the metric from the Kalman field. So from that bilinear action, we can obtain the following equations of motion. And along with the equations of motion, when we vary the action, we obtain some boundary conditions. oh, these would be the boundary conditions that we have to apply in order to get a discrete bullet supply inspection. We also have to impose, of course, finite kinetic energy, which provides another boundary condition, the normalizability condition, and we solve these equations. So the short answer is, well, I'm going to show you. There is a way. But in principle it looks very hard. You have 5.5 coupled differential system, but
subtracting first one minus half kappa times the second.
Sure. So of course there's a way. okay. So the way that we approach it is formulating a kind of radical harmonics
in analogy with the spherical harmonics from the two sphere. So first of all, let's perform a Kullitz supply decomposition for the field. We have a winding Kullitz supply number m, another Kullitz supply number n from the other compact dimension. That now plus and minus are some linear combination of the integral of h d to I and h phi I. So we can notice that these are both, of course, vectors, four-dimensional vectors, but these are scalars with respect to the two dimensions, and these are vectors with respect to the two dimensions. Now, we can find a complete basis for the two-dimensional scalar fields, it turns out, by solving for the 2D scalar Laplace thing. So we find the eigenvalues of the 2D scalar Laplacian along with the boundary conditions that I showed you before. When we impose the boundary conditions, it turns out that the differential operator is a Hermitian operator on the spatial function, and so we have it will have a complete set of orthogonal eigenfunctions and real eigenvalues. Similarly, we can find a complete basis for the 2D vector fields by solving this differential problem. It turns out that the mass eigenvalues for these two differential operators are the same, provided that the axial quantum number is either 0 or greater than or equal to 1 over omega. This is basically satisfied for all the modes if you have a positive tension domain. You remember this omega parameterizes the tension domain, and it's satisfied for some of the modes if you have a negative tension domain.
Brain, especially you want to consider deficit angle, that would be totally unstable, right?
So I mentioned that we place the brains in an orbital at this point. For the negative tension brains, they'll only be stable if they're not able to fluctuate.
Why do you need negative tension?
Sorry?
Why do you need negative tension?
We don't need negative tension. We're
changing just in case it was.
So when
these masses are the same, so it turns out that the scalar and vector harmonics obey a derivative relation, which is analogous to the derivative relation that happens for the Wigner functions on the sphere. And this enables us to decouple the system. So if we just plug in the radical harmonic expansion, we apply that derivative relation that I just showed you, we integrate the extra dimension. What we obtain is that the squared mass operator now becomes an algebraic matrix, which we can easily diagonalize. So we can find exactly the Kullitz supplying powers for the physical spin 1 perturbations about the Lagrange ball, and that's what it is. And along with the Calypso time axis, we also combine the explicit wave functions, which are functions in terms of the hypergeometric functions. So the points to note is first that the spectrum is free of taxonomic instabilities. Secondly, we can look at the masses mode. It turns out that within the spectrum, there are most three masses modes. For n equals 1, m is equal to 0, n equals 0, m equals to 1 over omega, and n equals to 0, and m is equal to minus 1 over omega. These, in general, 1 over omega is not an integer, so these don't exist. And we just have one massless Calypso time vector mode, which is what we'd expect because we have just the axial symmetry in the extra dimension. What's surprising is that for particular values of the negative tension grains, the deficit angles 0, minus 2 pi, minus 4 pi, and so on, we can have three massless Calypso time vectors. Of course, this when the deficit angle is 0, this is to be expected. We recover the sphere, and we have the SU2 isometries of the sphere. We should have three corresponding Calypso Klein vectors, or gauge fields. But what's surprising is that we can still have three Calypso Klein masses vectors when we introduce these special values of the negative tension grains. Despite that, of course, the brains are breaking the isometries of the sphere, the SU2 isometries of the sphere to U1. So, it turns out that this also can be understood because for these special values of the deficit angles, the geometry in the two dimensions has actually three well-defined queuing vectors, which obey the SU2 algebra. Of course, these queuing vectors cannot be integrated from the isometry because the brains clearly are breaking the isometry. But we do have these infinitesimal isometries, which are generated by the queuing vectors. So it turns out that the infinitesimal isometries are enough to guarantee massless Calypso Klein vector fields in the spectrum. We should then ask, do these massless vector fields correspond to gauge fields? And the answer is, the answer can only be found once we go beyond the bilinear action and look at the interactions. And it turns out that when we go beyond the bilinear action, we look at the interactions, what we find is that there's some Calypso Klein, the Calypso Klein mode, which do not fall into well-defined representations of this SU2. And so beyond the bilinear action, we do not see the SU2, an SU2 Calypso Klein gauge group. And so we don't expect that these massless vector fields will remain massless beyond the classical level. On the other hand, all the massless modes do fall into well-defined representations of this SU2. And so if we look at the low-energy vector field theory, which we find by truncating all the heavy Calypso Klein modes, we actually find an enhanced SU2 isometry, SU2 Calypso Klein gauge group in the cases where we have these special values for the functions of the brain. So despite having no isometry in the extra dimensions, it's enough to have an infinitesimal isometry to have a Calypso Klein gauge group in the low-energy vector field.
The boundary conditions we get are just the ones that we have to choose to derive the equations of motion from the action.
What were they?
When you start off with the bilinear action to get the equations of motion, we do the variation, and for the boundary conditions to be zero, in that variation,
So you're not allowing yourself to have a contribution from the brain action to those boundary conditions.
Well, remember the brain is just pure tension. So, I mean, for example, it's not going to contribute to the...
But for the metric,
the metric,
I'm wondering if that would be why you're not seeing the brain break the symmetry. In the...
I don't remember. I think we must have. I don't remember. I have to take a look again.
What is the bulk profile of audition method in spectrum?
Say again.
Bulk profile. Additional messages, but
for the additional messages filled, they're basically exactly the same as what you would get for the stereo. So there's nothing special about them.
Do they vanish? The derivative of wave function vanish at the pores?
No, they don't. Because I'm gonna show you some wave profiles. I'll show you.
Okay, so let me, that I showed you the results for the Kaluza Klein spectrum for the spin 1 field. We've actually derived the Kaluza Klein spectrum for all the bosonic sectors, so let me just summarize the results. First of all, the masses modes are the masses for the graviton 1 or 3 masses for the vector. 2 masses for these scalars, these can all be expected from this, looking at the symmetries of the solution, the background solution. And these are all separated from the Kaluza Klein power by a mass gap, which is of order the size of the actual dimension, more or less. Secondly, the tachyonic instabilities are absent from most of the sectors, but they can arise from internal components of the 16 gauge field charged under the monopole background. In particular, also basically this depends on the charges that are present in the theory and on the strength of the monopole. And basically, I mean, this is, I think, just a note that this is telling you that more generically, you should be careful when you're introducing fluxes in non-abelian sectors, because this is quite generic, that non-abelian fluxes can have instability. Secondly, what we find is, in answer to your question, Simon, we find a universal behavior for the wave function localization properties of all the modes. So, for an example that I've plotted here for some fermions, so there's a massless mode here amongst the n equal to minus 1 spectrum. What I plotted is n equals 0, 1, and 2 modes, the massless mode is for n is equal to 0, what we find is that if the masses mode is localized at one of the grains, or the Kaluza Klein power is localized at the grains, at the brain. And this is a very generic property, basically. All the Kaluza Klein modes have the same properties at the grains. So having analyzed almost all, the bosonic fluctuations and some of the fermionic fluctuations, we think we can now suggest the following about the properties of co-dimensional two brains. First of all, models with only positive tension brains have qualitatively the same physics as standard Kaluza Klein compatibilizations. So in particular, in these co-dimensional two brains, the warping models, the warping is power law in the proper distance from the brain, as opposed to exponential in the five-dimensional models. And this power law warping actually has qualitatively the same physics as the unwarped models, at least in terms of the qualitative behavior of the Kaluza Klein spectrum. However, we can find some novel behavior of the Kaluza Klein spectrum in the presence of negative tension brains. For example, if we look at the volume of the extra dimensions, it turns out to have this behavior. R0 over 2 is basically the radius of the sphere. There's the deficit angle. So notice that we can make the volume of the extra dimensions large by turning on a large negative deficit angle. And in this way, we keep doing this, we actually keep the mass gap large. So in principle, we can have the volume and the mass gap are actually independent from each other, and we can have large extra dimensions, keeping the mass gap large, so hiding the fixed prime modes with a large mass gap. Secondly, as I told you, we find that the number of massless vector fields can be enhanced beyond the isometries, thanks to the presence of infinitesimal isometries. And finally, just to note that it turns out that the low energy effective field theory that we obtain by truncating the massless mode, the low energy effective field theory for special saddle spheres, these special saddle spheres with the infinitesimal isometries of the sphere, is actually indistinguishable from the low energy effective field theory of the smooth sphere. So let me conclude. So first of all, the point I want to make is that brains and supersymmetric large extra dimensions may provide an interesting approach to the cosmological constant problem about energy. Brains in six-dimensional supergravity provide a laboratory to explore these ideas and also co-dimension two brains in general. Models with positive tension brains, it turns out, seem to have a similar behavior for the Kaluza-Klein spectrum to standard Kaluza-Klein compactification. On the other hand, it seems that negative tension brains provide some physics. I think that this analysis of the spectrum is a good step towards understanding how the vacuum energy contributions cancel amongst the six-dimensional supermultiple in these models. We already have the Kaluza-Klein spectrum for some super some partners for a full supermultiple. So we can now use the machinery of vacuum energy calculations for 4D Kaluza-Klein modes. We can apply this now to our Kaluza-Klein spectrum and get some results for the vacuum energy contributions in these warped models. And finally, as Cliff noted, supersymmetric large dimensions have many and diverse predictions within upcoming experiments, and it seems an interesting thing to look at.
So it's maybe a general question. How do you get like FRW cosmology between these 60 large extra dimensions?
Great difficulty.
The reason I'm asking that, like in 5D, random sangam two brains, people have shown that if you don't stabilize the extra dimension, the cosmology you get a wrong cosmology. All the signs are wrong, so you need to stabilize them at the matter source to Ramanujan syndrome T brain and get the standard FRW cosmology with small corrections. So then in your setup, you have all sorts of moduli brains and. So then if you add matter on there on one of these brains. How do you notice, how do you take care of the stabilization and how do you recover the FRW?
I had a whole wrap of slides that I didn't click on. And the short version of it is that another way of saying what there's only one modulus to worry about, which is the size of this, the breathing mode of the extra dimensions. Because the other ones, given that your large radius, given the cosmology is happening at variable energies compared to the millimeter scale, that's the relevant change to the FRW cosmology. So the question becomes, can you make a viable cosmology out of the scalar tensor theory that you get at low energies? And in particular, you need to have it, you don't need to stabilize it, but you need to have it be potential energy dominated in order to give you the equation state of the dark energy. And so, and at face value, it looks hard because the potential energy you get that I was pointing to the 1/r before, if you write that as a canonical variable, that's an exponential potential, which doesn't like to have potential combination. But the thing I didn't show in the slides was that if you actually calculate the vacuum energy, the Casimir energy on a sphere, it's not 1/r before, it's actually times a plus b log r. There's logarithmic corrections on a sphere that you don't normally get on a torus, let's say. And so in terms of the canonical variable, you have exponential potentials with polynomials in front of the exponential. And it happens that the polynomials give you shape in the potential. It gives you a shoulder, basically, an exponential, which can potential dominate. And that generically happens at very large values of the radius because it's when the logarithm of R is of the order of the ratio of parameters on your in your potential. So for a mild hierarchy of parameters in potential, you get this shoulder of a very large R. So the cosmology you get is a scalar tensor cosmology where what you see now is this basically are rolling over the shoulder where the potential energy is dominating the energy. And the reason you don't overshoot that is that the Hubble friction is so incredibly efficient that the radius doesn't go very far. So all the various kind of bounds you might worry about that the Newton's constant is changing because the radius is changing and that kind of thing turn out to be, they're not they're soluble, but not for generic initial conditions, but it's you can have the system look like cosmology the way you see it now.
But you said that the breathing mode doesn't, is not a dangerous thing to be
defined. That's the dark energy in this picture. It's a quintessence
model. How do you know that you get the standard of our data in your cosmology? For example, in the London Shandom 2 with no stabilization, which is the brain, it's like a moduli. If you add the matter source on the TV brain, you get the FRW cosmology with the negative sign for the effective Newton constant, which was the pathology of not stabilizing the random Shandom setup. So
it's not obvious, but you have to sit down to the calculation and it makes a scalar tensor cosmology, which can be made to work. It's not, I'm not saying it's generic that it works, but it's there's model building you have to do, but the class of Lagrangians you get allows a cosmology like what we see.
So in this picture you can get both brains to get colored. So
if you don't have an energy was not really pathology. They just didn't understand how gravity was induced.
No, but in Ramana Chandra you have this field which is like the position of the separation between these two brains. So if you don't stabilize them, that could be like the massless field.
No, sure.
That one's stabilized. Let's take a case that the only modulus is this breathing mode, and if you try to move the brains away from each other, that corresponds to actually making the space get bigger. So there's only one massless mode. It's not like there's two.
So when you have multiple fields on the internal space, genetically the Rakoff is going to have zero modes.
Exactly.
What's their role in fundamental theory? Can you interpret the generations or something?
Yeah, so we indeed, so we do indeed have massless pyrophenions in the spectrum, thanks to the background monocle. And also we can also have more depending on the deficit angles that are present. So the deficit angles also help in producing massless fermions. And if you want to take that perspective and in terms of getting, say, the standard model from the bulk fields, it can be done. You can find massless fermions. Is that your question? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you did put a boundary condition term in, that, like a tension term, and changed your metric boundary condition at the brain with that, would that have complicated your diagonalization of the various modes, kinetic energies of the various modes?
Yeah. So let me repeat the question. You're asking if we were to modify the boundary conditions, including
include the tension in the brain.
Yeah, I'm really sorry. I just cannot remember.
But you mean
I'm surprised if we didn't do it. So I feel like we did. I think we must have included those brain tensions in the boundary
condition. I guess I was expecting that because normally the boundary condition as a field approach to the brain, it depends on the properties of the brain you chose. So there's some matching calculation that happens, but as far as the equation of motion go, that just comes in as a boundary condition of the brain position. But so the fact that your boundary conditions didn't depend on the brains makes it sound like it hasn't included.
I had the impression you just have the pure tension of the background on the brain, and you don't include something. So you don't include an extra tension at the perturbed level, so it's just there.
Well, there's a couple of metrics, though, so why didn't the metric?
So you use the up-down
metric. Yeah. If you use the up-down metric, it's.
Right.
In equal motion, it's not perturbed.
Right. Yeah. If you use T upstairs, you're down, so you're right. It's got no perturbation.
But you could put attention at the perturbed level and then an extra something which is not the same. And
you mean to put every 10 years?
Yeah. And just having that, is you're not going to have any blowing up. It's still going to remain nice. But,
thank you. Yeah.
Can you explain to me that zero mode for negative tension brain physically, what is that mode?
So that mode is really because for those negative deficit angles, there is a well-defined killing vector on the internal mode, on the internal space. So
on the what? On the. It comes from where?
Because you start off with a sphere, and then you're introducing tensions which give rise to deficit angles, which are minus multiples of 2 pi. And so then it's very easy to see that geometry has well-defined killing vectors, which are basically those the same ones as the sphere, but with, say, the azimuthal angle redefined by an integer. Right?
And also on the podium has some chakra.
We start off with a metric. Of the sphere. And if we introduce the deficit angles, you can see that you can just absorb it into the definition of the azimuthal angle, right? And if the deficit angles are just integer multiples of minus of 2 pi, this is just going to be an integer. And then you can just imagine what the killing vectors of the sphere have, like sines, sine 5 or 5 and these things.
For that to be, delta has to be very big.
Sorry? Delta has to be, yeah. It's you're adding deficit angles, which are 2 pi, which are multiples of 2 pi. So it's true that it's, I don't know how you want to take it. I mean, for me, it's just the truth of it, the existence that the standard Kulitzer-Klein law and standard Kulitzer-Klein behavior doesn't break the tune. But I mean, you're adding, yeah.
I have a curious question about how this works, like from a four-dimensional low-energy perspective. So basically, if I understand already, there's a low-energy that's basically this nearly symmetric scale, the couple scale, very weakly coupled to the matter on the brain, and let's say I perturb something on the other brain, the field of experiment. What happens to this scalar field that allows me to somehow not create the data online? What, from a four-dimensional low-energy perspective, what is going on to this scalar field that somehow magically make me not feel not feel any effect if I, you know, let's say I do a thought experiment to perturb something on this other brain, so that now I don't have this, I move away from this kind of nice bad situation where I have no curvature on my brain. What happened to my scalar field that actually somehow let me adjust? I mean, it almost looks like, I wonder if from a four-dimensional low-energy, what's going on with this scalar field?
Well, so generically you would see it. So that was the statement that it's not a self-turning thing. So if you, from the four-dimensional point of view, if you didn't do any quantum corrections, you just literally have a massless scalar field coupled to gravity, coupled to whatever other place field are. So then if you dinged it, you know, you change the tension or something by just an amount which is not so much energy that you would excite Kulitzer-Klein modes, and what you'd do is that you would this flat direction, you just kick it and it would start to roll, and there'd be nothing to stop it because there's no potential energy barrier.
Yes.
And so then it just roll off to infinity or to zero or wherever it's going to go. And it, when it gets far enough, eventually the four dimensional theory starts to break down because that's carrying with it the Klein scale. And then you'll either run off to flat six dimensional space or to two dimensions will implode.
I see.
So that means that when you put a potential energy in, you can make the cosmology work, but it's not going to be generic that it works. So you can start off with it. You can start that field rolling in such a way that it never experiences a potential energy domination. And that was the initial condition problem.
So is it true that if I do it randomly, then my borderline will roll, so that Newton's constant will change, and your scalar field will roll, so the CC will change. Is that the picture I get?
I think so.
Okay.
The thing that was random was what? You're varying a different vacuum, you mean? Or?
No, I mean, the question how much fine tune. So, for example, initial condition, when you say fine tune, how much fine tune you need such that.
Oh. So in the four dimensional theory, you can be more precise. And so there's several. So as far as initial conditions go, it's not so bad in the sense that you can have pretty much generic. You can have as much kinetic energy in that scalar field as you have in everything else at nuclear distances. And Hubble friction just sucks it away from you, so it's not very damaging. And in the process, even though you had a lot of kinetic energy, you don't actually roll very far because of the Hubble damping, so that the bounds on changing Newton's constant are very difficult to satisfy. The main thing you have to have is you have to have the value of the radius at nuclear distances be essentially what it is now, because it's not going to move much. And you know that now it's big, so you have to have some reason why you would have come in with a large radius already. But there's a different kind of tuning, which is something which is a bit more difficult to arrange is something which you said that the scalar field is not coupling very strongly to matter, and actually in face value it's coupling very strongly. It wants to be a brand sticky scalar with a brand sticky parameter like 2 or -2.
So can I use the chameleon mechanism?
I don't know how, because the potential is not the right shape, but the thing is that the same logarithmic corrections that appear in the potential appear in the matter coupling. So that the thing is that it's a brand sticky scalar whose leading contribution is 2, but it's 2 plus something log r. And because that log r dependence makes it a very, very slowly varying function of the field. But once it's slowly varying, it's time dependent in the cosmology. So what you do is you arrange for it to be passing through 0 now, because all the bounds are now. Mm-hmm. And so that's the loophole you're using. So it's not, and that's something which is completely contrived. It doesn't like to live there. It just chooses to put it there just as an existence proof that it doesn't need to be a problem, and then come back to that. But generically, you're going to want to have couplings to this scalar field that could be dangerous. So.
So the statement you made earlier about is the having no longer solar system has to by making this choice.
It was that choice, right? Right. And so one of the things we're looking at is that if that's really the way it works, then stars, for instance, when they formed, because you can't make it small all the time. It varies. It doesn't vary by a lot because the radius doesn't change much. But given that it varies, that means when astrophysical objects formed, they would have been formed when the scalar coupling was bigger. And also, it could be varying in space now, so across the galaxy it could be different. So the question is, can you get an interesting bound out of the binary pulsar, say, and that kind of thing? Given that you're living off this field dependence of the coupling.
Okay, so maybe we can continue the discussion from the bike. And we're running a little bit now. Shall we reconvene at 25? How fast? Yeah, then we're gonna eat very late.